In today's episode, I have the honor to talk to President Egils Levits. Only to mention a few highlights of his career, President Levits was judge at the European Court of Human Rights from 1995 to 2004, judge at the European Court of Justice from 2004 to 2019, and president of the Republic of Latvia from 2019 to 2023. In this final episode of the first season of the Energy Law podcast, we are zooming out again from the in-depth discussions of different parts of energy law, talking about the geopolitical changes after Russia's invasion of Ukraine that also affected global and European energy markets. With President Levits, I'm going to discuss the role of courts and transitions, also exploring the concept of judicial activism. Please enjoy this episode. Thank you so much again for agreeing to be in this podcast, Mr. President Levits.
Yeah, it's a pleasure for me.
I had also the pleasure to meet you a few years ago already because I was applying for my postdoctoral judicial traineeship at the European Court of Justice. I remember that for the Latvian cabinet.
Yeah.
And I remember that you had the interview with me. But my pity, once I started my traineeship there, you were already president of Latvia.
Yeah. Okay. I said that you can come, but when you were already there, I was not more
exactly.
there.
Exactly. I had the pleasure to work with Kuhn Lennartz then, but sadly not with you. If you don't mind, just to start off, could you just share a little bit about your career path?
So I was born in Riga, 1955, and 1972, our family left Riga, but was occupied by Soviet Union for Germany. And then I studied in Hamburg law, and then political science. So I have both degrees. And I started the career as a usual German lawyer, was referendär in Schleswig-Holsteinisches Oberlandesgericht. And after that, I was academic referent at the Universität Kiel, and then at the Institute for German and East European Studies in Göttingen. Hmm. And then already in Latvia, started the movement for independence, and I joined this movement. I was involved in preparation of different legal documents, especially Declaration of Renewal of Independence. I was advisor to the Latvian parliament, and then after the first free elections, I became deputy of the parliament, but also I was deputy prime minister and minister of justice. When the government changed after the next election, then I was ambassador to Germany, ambassador to Austria, Hungary, Swiss, I should say a diplomatic career. And after the diplomatic career, I started career as judge, first 9 years in Strasbourg, and then 15 years at the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg. And after this career as European judge, I became president of the Republic of Latvia. Therefore, while the parliament could not agree on one candidate, and they asked someone from outside, so to say, and I agreed, and then I was 4 years president of Latvia. And now I participating in different think tanks, I'm giving lectures, participating in conferences. So I am, so to say, rather in academic or political sphere to teach something or to give my opinion on geopolitics and on legal issues.
When you became president of the Republic of Latvia, did you think that it would be such a paradigm shift in geopolitical relationships?
No, absolutely not. It was not previsible. The first crisis during my presidency, we experienced two global crises. The first crisis was COVID crisis, and the second was, of course, the Russian aggression against Ukraine. COVID crisis was absolutely un, unpredictable. It was a surprise for all, for the whole world. The Russian aggression against Ukraine. Also, we in Latvia know always that Russia is an aggressive country, especially when Russia already started the aggression against Ukraine 2014, and then there would be a continuation. So it was not a real surprise. But of course, this was a crisis, European security crisis and global security crisis.
And do you remember also the 24th of February 2022?
Yes, on 24th of February, I was in Hamburg because I should deliver a speech, European speech at the university. And I was waken up by my security advisor on 4 o'clock in the morning, and he said 15 minutes ago the Russia started the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and I was supposed immediately to go back to Latvia, and my speech I postponed for 1 year. I held this speech last year. 2023.
Yeah, so I think that was probably incredible news that you heard there. How do you react on something like that as president of a European country?
I must say that in our security informations and intelligence informations about the Russian aggression was already 3-4 months before that. And it was not only clear which day, which hour they will start the aggression, but it was clear that there would be this full-scale war against Ukraine. So it was not a real surprise. And because such a scale of war needs some preparations, and these preparations could be monitored also by Western intelligence services, by satellites and so on. Also, it was not a real surprise. It was a real surprise that exact on 24th, on 4 o'clock in the morning. But it was clear that in the next days there would be such kind of starting of war.
How has Russia's invasion of Ukraine reshaped the geopolitical landscape in Europe?
Yes, with this full-scale invasion, the international peace order, which was established in 1945 by the establishment of the United Nations with the new peace order, this peace order came to the end. Also, 74 years later. For 74 years, it was more or less effective. There were several, I would say, local wars. And there was only one case, like this case in Ukraine. It was invasion, full-scale invasion and annexation of Kuwait, 1991. This is the only one precedent. But the international community, under the leadership of US, reacted properly. And there was action against the aggressor, Iraq, and the independence of Kuwait was restored. This is the second case since the Second World War, which is not comparable with maybe one or two dozens territorial conflicts between several countries. Territorial conflicts, territorial disputes, which between two states, but there was no case when one country wanted to extinct another independent country. It was, as I said, only Kuwait. It was restored, but then it's a second case, and this means that this world peace order is away. And now we are in the situation of uncertainty. What will be the next security or peace order in the world? After the crash of the Soviet Union in 1990, there was a hope of the West that then we will have eternal period of peace and maybe in sooner or later also democracy in the whole world. Fukuyama has written his famous book, End of the History. This hope was not realistic because in Western liberal thinking, there was no place for aggressive stance. But unfortunately, this is not the thinking of the whole world. After maybe 10 years of also certain crisis and instability in Russia, since 2000, when Putin became president, there was a very consequent politics to shape a new ideology, the new ideology Russian world, and this ideology is aggressive to other countries. The ideology consists of several principles, but the two main principles are, first, the special historical role of the Russian nation, Auserwähltes Volk. It stems, this idea, from the Pan-Slavists of the 19th century. It's nothing new, but new is this revival. And the second idea is to be surrounded always by enemies. And this is a paranoid thinking, but these two principles are shaping the new ideology, which is aggressive towards other countries, and which is repressive inside, also in Russia, because it's genuinely anti-democratic. There is certain analogies with Nazi ideology, but there is also important differences. One of the differences is that Nazi ideology was oriented to the person of the leader. And if their leader is away, then of course the ideology became, so to say, it's difficult for the ideology to survive without the leader. This is different by Russian ideology. It's not oriented on the person of Putin. It can survive, it can continue its existence without Putin also. It's more resistant to historical changes, I would say. So now we are facing with aggressive Russia and also with a China which is oriented also to play out his economic strength. We should imagine that the percentage of world GDP of China 2000, in the year 2000, it was 4%. And 20 years later, it was 18%. It's a huge shift. The percentage of Europe goes down from 25% to 15% or 16%. Also, the half. And US also from 30 to 25%. By Russia, in the way, it's from 3.2 to 1.6, also the half, and the economic strength of Russia is that of Spain, of South Korea, and like this middle-sized countries. But of course, Russia is investing in military. Military is strong, but outside the military sector, also relatively weak. So, and in this new multilateral world, the West should find their own role. Also, not to be dominated by autocratic powers, China and Russia, and at least preserve itself. And the preserving of the West means more or less preserving of democracy, because outside the West, democracy is maybe not so stable, also not always, so to say, has a good stance. So we are at the beginning of a new era, I would say, the era of the domination of the West came to the end. And the new era will be more or less shaped by autocratic powers And then it's, of course, a question for the West, what to do in this new situation.
Russia was also a big supplier of natural gas to Europe. Also some materials for production of nuclear energy in Europe came to a large extent from Russia. So there are also some impacts in the supply chains since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Was Latvia affected by this as well?
Latvia was also impacted, also the same as Germany, but we have relatively quick reoriented our energy supply chains from Russian gas to gas which was imported from the world market. So Germany has also done it very quick, I would say. Within 1 year, there was practically no more imports of gas from Russia. I think this process of reorientation was surprisingly quick and effective. Now for the energy sector, I think the next question is how to go from fossil energy resources to green energy resources. It's a more long-term question and with transitional periods and so on. For Latvia, it's also not so big problem because half of our energy is coming from hydro energy, already a green energy, and we are investing in wind energy and solar energy, so that for Latvia this transition is going on relatively quick. But of course, for parts of Europe and also for US, it's a big issue. Also, how to shorten the time that we can say adieu to fossil energy resources.
And so green energy can also support independence, let's put it this way. Yeah? Because then maybe if it's produced in Europe itself.
Yeah, I think there is disagreement whether atomic energy could be regarded as green or not. This is a very famous dispute between France and Germany. I would say I have, so to say, not specific opinion on that. We don't have atomic energy in Latvia. It's not an issue for us. But we should see in the European Union that we can become, so to say, really independent from other sources of energy. And if I see correctly, that also the fuel for atomic plants coming from outside Europe, from Niger in the first place, also from Iran, also from Russia. There are also production of uran, I think, in France and in Estonia, by the way. But mostly it's imported. So that in terms of independence, I would say atomic energy is also not completely independent, like hydro energy, like solar energy, like wind energy.
You were also already mentioning the European Union. So these responses also to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, you said Latvia adapted very quickly to the new geopolitical landscape. Germany changed their sources of energy supply. But the EU also presented in May 2022 the Repower EU plan, also as a response to the invasion of Ukraine. And that also brings us to the fact that the European level plays an important role after Russia's attack, but also in general in shaping transitions, etc. You were for many years judge at the European Court of Justice. From your perspective, what is the role of the European Court of Justice in these transitions?
The European Court of Justice is not shaping, but applying the European law. And to take the political decisions is up to the political organs of the European Union, it's up to the European Council and up to the European Parliament. But of course, there are certain discretions always, or in most cases, by the interpretation of European law. And we are, European Court of Justice has interpreted European laws. And then by these interpretations, I think the European Court of Justice mostly has also thought what would be the consequences of the interpretation A, of interpretation B of one European norm. And then, of course, we should promote such kind of future-oriented political goals of the European Union within the methods of interpretation, I would say. Also, it's in first place, it's up to the political organs of the European Union to think about the transformation. It's European Court of Justice, also European Court of Human Rights, also national constitutional courts, national supreme courts, always dealing, like the parliaments and like the governments, with political issues, that I would stress, political issues. But the approach between political organs and the judiciary is different. The political players, political organs, are asking in which kind of world we want to live. What should be the future? This is the task of the politicians to answer this question. The question of judiciary, of the courts, is what says the law today? So, therefore, but the question is the same, also the matter is the same, but what the law is saying today, it's the judicial approach, what should be the future is political approach. So therefore, it's two sides of the same coin. And each, the political organs and judicial organs, have their place and their task in a system based of rule of law, in a democratic system.
Some people would probably disagree to what you just said. They would probably say, no, it's not only applying the law, it's also shaping the law, what the ECJ does.
Yeah.
Especially if you also look at the interpretation methods, the interpretation in the light of the FAUTIL, people would probably say the European Court of Justice may even take the stand of some judicial activism.
Yes, yes. This is an eternal question. So I said applying the law, but by applying the law, you cannot avoid certain discretion. If the law is formulated in a way that you can give several answers, maybe two answers at least, and both answers are right from the point of view of judicial methodology, then you should choose it. This is, so to say, a certain kind of judicial politics or judicial activism. And I said already to you that, in my view, if Supreme Courts, if European Court of Justice is applying the law, it's always under the heading applying the law. The courts will never say that we are shaping the law. Mm-hmm. As under the heading applying the law, they should take into account the context, the political context, and also to see to the consequences of the choice of interpretation A, of interpretation B would be better. And this is indeed a kind of political choice. And therefore, it was from maybe 100 years ago, this thinking that law and politics are absolutely two separate spheres and they're never never came together. It's not realistic. Realistic is that the judges should be aware that in specific ways they are also shaping the future. Also, and that means shaping the future. That means making politics. And we should not deny that. We should admit that and be also responsible with this specific power.
And so the judges at the European Court of Justice have to deal with plenty of questions coming from totally different areas, such as EU external relations law, but then also suddenly energy law. There might pop up an energy law question that also may need the understanding of complex technical issues or economic questions that may arise also in the context of applying the law. How do the judges deal with this?
So complex issues, problem of complex issues, technical issues, or also uncertain consequences and so on. I think a good principle is on French is deference judiciaire. That means to ask which organ, which institution is best placed to answer this specific question. By difficult technical questions, especially when it is necessary to weigh up the consequences. Of course, the judges are not engineers and they cannot give the right answer to that. Then the court should say the best. Also, best place is not the court, but European Commission, because European Commission has dozens and hundreds of specialists in this area. They know better, and that means we should rely on this assessments. Of course, judicial questions be answered by the court, and therefore we should always try by such kind of complex issues. Try to distinguish between the complexes which should be resolved by institutions which are specialized or which have specialists for that, like European Commission or in national systems, the government. The government has plenty of specialists, and also there are hearings of parliament where specialists are giving their opinions and so on. And the judge cannot say, oh, it's all false, I think so and so. We should rely on that. And I think this approach to ask for the court whether we are best in the best position to take this question. If not, then we should give back this question for a resolution to the institution which is better placed, which is more competent to resolve the issue. But the judicial issues, of course, it's an issue for the court.
And you were also a judge at the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. Mm-hmm. So do you see any differences in approaching cases in both courts?
If I can continue what from the previous question, the cases before the European Court of Human Rights were in the most cases not so complex as in the European Court of Justice. We had not decided on technical issues, on weighing up between different consequences, on so. I think it is more judicial issues, but we have what we are regarding as human rights, and this depends also from that what in German we are saying Menschenbild, and this Menschenbild is the core, or also the core of all human rights which are enshrined in convention, and this is mostly, or in all cases, purely judicial question. But in order to answer this judicial question, it is necessary to look back to this Menschenbild.
So the perspective on how.
What is a human, and what human has is his real core of the personality. And I think it's a different approach as by European Court of Justice, which has really very complex issues. The issues in European Court of Human Rights, not very complex, but not means easy. It might have different ethical dilemmas, and to choose between ethical dilemmas is also necessary to think about more deeply. So to say, it's a different kind of matter and also different kind of approach between the two courts.
And maybe coming back to the question of judicial activism, the European Court of Human Rights also has some really landmark judgments that will shape also the future of the people. on April 9, 2024, the European Court of Human Rights made a judgment against Switzerland to take more actions against climate change. Is this not judicial activism, or how is such a very far-reaching decision enshrined in the human rights?
Yes, I have read the judgments. It's indeed was it is unique, this judgment. And if you are reading carefully, then the European Court of Human Rights was not dealing with difficult weighing up between several consequences of the politics of the government and so on. It was in reality not about what is to do in order to preserve climate, but it was about the obligations of the Swiss government, of a government which derives from international agreements which Swiss has agreed and which was adopted by Swiss. And also it was a judicial question whether the obligation is fulfilled or not fulfilled. And the court found it's not fulfilled. And therefore, I would say it's impractically, it is a judicial issue. It was solved by judicial interpretation, and it's, I would say, self-evident that if an agreement is signed, the agreement should be executed, should be fulfilled. And this was what the court said. And therefore, I cannot see that it was really a case of judicial activism.
So zooming out a little bit, maybe also again, we talked about your time as president of the Republic of Latvia. We talked a little bit about your time as a judge at the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg, then the European, or before that, the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. What were the moments in your career path that kind of shaped your own thinking the most? What were some pivotal moments that maybe you want to also share a little bit with our listeners?
Yes, in my career, I had to to work practically in all spheres of a state. In state administration, I was a referendaire in der Stadt Plön.
Okay.
I, so to say, administration.
City council.
City
administration.
City administration. Because they don't want to have a lawyer, but they always take these referendaires as judicial decernent, I would say.
Yeah, the postgraduate judicial trainees. Difficult translation for the German word.
So then I was in diplomacy, I then was in the government, I was elected in the parliament, and of course then in international or European judiciary. So to say, I can see the state from different perspectives, and each perspective was first time and new for me. But altogether, I think now it is a certain advantage that I can see the state from all perspectives. And when I came to European Court of Human Rights, it was new for me, and the European Court of Justice also, and also the presidency was new for me. But of course, the previous experiences helped. And I think by each step of this career, or it was not really step which was step one, step two, step three, this was different directions, the previous experiences were helpful.
And some moments that you think this is something that where I wasn't able to sleep for several nights, or something that was a big challenge?
It was always a challenge, but I think relatively, say, ruhiger Mensch. Yeah. So, and of course,
experienced person.
And
probably,
of course, yeah. If you are giving the oath as a president of the state, of course, I thought in the moment, by the way, it's interesting, I was born in Riga during the Soviet occupation, and my family was repressed by both occupation powers, by Germans during Second World War and by Soviets. My grandparents were deported to Siberia and so on. And I was born then. And I thought, in order to become president of Latvia, an empire should break up. Without the breakup of the Soviet Union, I would never be president of Latvia. Mm-hmm. Also, it was a such strange thing what I thought at the moment. Also, this historical change during one life.
Yeah, I think your career path, your life is in that sense very unique. I think I don't know anybody else who combines all these perspectives also on the state such as you. So yeah. I'm very thankful that you took your time for joining us today, Mr. President.
Yeah, thank you very much. Also, all the best for you. It was very interesting talk about different issues, judicial, political, personal. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
The first season of the Energy Law Podcast was made possible with funds of the Dutch Starter Grant Program, awarded by Tilburg University for my project, Transformation Processes in European and National Economic Law, Energy Law as Law of Socio-Technical Change. A special thanks for production support goes out to Mark Ohrendorf from Irgendwas mit Recht.